Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Focused on Albany. I'm your host, Cynthia Pooler, and my guest today is Green Party member Dan Platt, who ran for county executive. And Dan is here to talk about Jill Stein's presidential campaign. Hi, Dan. How are you today?
I'm good.
Good.
Happy
there was
to be
an
here.
Article in the Times Union yesterday, which Chris Churchill wrote, and he kind of referred to Jill Stein as a elitist. And he was saying all kinds of things about, you know, the internet and the student loan debt crisis. And he thinks that she's a gimmick. So there's been a lot of press about her in a little bit of an unflattering light. So basically, can you talk about how you feel the media has treated Jill Stein?
Yeah, I can. So I didn't read this, but I probably don't have to because I've probably read it a few times already from other sources. I don't think it's a gimmick to be for working people. I don't think it's a gimmick to represent working people's interests, their agenda, and their movements. For the most part, the Democratic Party, both parties, do not represent working people. They don't represent us. And this is Chris Churchill's column represents a broader media attack on the Greens and on political alternatives, especially since Clinton makes lefties hypocrites, any kind of lefty or liberal, because they've been put in this position of supporting the status quo or in a false dichotomy, they must be supporting Trump. A certain meme is that if the DNC isn't scared of installing someone like Clinton, who could lose to Trump, then they don't scare me. They will not scare me into voting for her. Something to talk about is how I'm not so big fan of mechanistic thinking, right? Like A causes B. But before the 90s, before the Clinton administration, now I'm talking Bill Clinton, there were 50 or 60 large media companies. After the Clinton administration and the passage of the 96 Telecommunications Act, yes, it was under Republican Congress, but Bill Clinton signed it, and he pushed for it. Now, after a bit of time, we have 6 media companies. All of the country's media, whether it be newspapers, television, a lot of radio, with the exception of small islands of independent journalism, journalism done by nonprofits, and other civil society organizations, it's all 6 companies. And all 6 of these companies give to the Hillary Clinton campaign. They give to the Democrats. They give to both parties because both parties are the wholly owned subsidiaries of the 1% of the ruling class, of the uber rich, or of our corporate economy. An old definition of fascism is the fusion of corporate and state power. If that can't be exist, it can be argued that that exists already today, especially since most laws that are passed on the national or state level are in corporate interests. Whether it's the nanotech, whether it's something we can point to 100 things locally, where whatever government is doing is either propping up, protecting, or advancing corporate power over the power of those who do work, working people. And Chris Churchill is one, it's double talk that he is calling people who speak for the issues that we care about as elitist when he speaks for the elite. And if the Hearst newspaper, Times Union, wants to have a message that we're for working people, then there need to be columns written by civil society people here in Albany. You know, Willie White should have a column. Other activists, you know, Angelica of Black Lives Matter should have a column. They should have a voice in the paper that's the same drumbeat that these so-called lefty voices, the editor of Mother Jones, the editor of all these magazines and publications that used to be part of left-wing culture, are now, they've all been gobbled up by large companies, basically subdivisions of the Big Six. Time Warner, GE, Disney, and others. I can't remember all of them, but there's the three of them. So those are the three that operate around us.
In the article that he wrote, he talks about the student loan debt crisis, which, you know, I've devoted a number of shows on. And he said, Stein's gimmickry magic trick would be an especially generous subsidy for wealthy professionals, doctors and lawyers, while doing nothing for those who didn't go to college, are struggling most in the post-industrial economy. It would exacerbate income inequality. That's how he views the idea of forgiving student loan debt.
I find that a bit rich. That's certainly a very distorted view of society, and it has, and of course, it is, of course, it's distorted because it's coming from a very entitled and privileged place himself. Who is Chris Churchill? Is he one of these men? You know, what kind of life experience does he have? But I do not want to make it about this individual, because this is a general culture, and it comes from an ignorance of what our policies really are. What are we really about? So he calls student loan forgiveness a magic trick, kind of like how technology, advanced enough technology appears to be magic. Well, an advanced policy position or advanced theory of how things work does seem like magic, unless it's properly explained, unless you're educated about it. So let me do a little bit now. So part of student loan forgiveness, how it is done, it's part of the policy is to nationalize the Fed, to bring it under public control, at least. You know, it's still a big state bank, right? But at least bring it out of, so it's not pseudo-private anymore, right? Its board is private bankers. It is a tool of Wall Street. Let's at least make it a tool of the state, you know, the public trust, so to speak. As undemocratic as that can be, it's still more democratic than Wall Street. And you nationalize the Fed, and then we use the Fed to pretty much print money, create money, to the access of the amount of debt there is. And it's $1 trillion. It's over $1 trillion. And that's not just doctors and lawyers. Mm-hmm. It's people like me. It's people who majored in art. It's people who majored in the humanities. To say that it's just the uber technical, the uber specialized, maybe those are the professionals, the college graduates, Chris Churchill, interacts with, but I'm on the ground interacting with people who majored in biology, who majored in, you know, other kinds of sciences, other kinds of arts, and all the things in between. And they're all struggling. They're working two part-time jobs. They are working for pittance wages. That is the world I see, and that is the world that we need to address. And how we can address that, and this is a bit heady, but we need to address how we create money. It's said that money does not grow on trees. That's laughable because money actually doesn't come from anywhere. We create it. Rather, banks create it for a profit. Mm-hmm. It is a type of landlordism. It's like they create money and then rent it to us with interest, right? That's what interest is. It's a form of rent. And this is important because the 40% of the cost of everything in our economy, every product, every service, 40% can be linked to interest. The interest that banks charge us for using the price they charge us to use currency. And to those constitutional buffs listening, the Constitution grants the state the ability to make money, right, to coin money, to create currency. That's why there was always a fight in the early republic of whether or not there should be a state bank. Whole elections hinged on this question. It was kind of solved with the creation of the Fed, and ever since, we've had this steady monetary policy that's been in the interests of corporate America. And they've done really well over the last century. Workers did that at a time because they were organized and they were able to fight for their interests, right? And they were able to align with parties, both the Democratic Party and third parties, like the Socialist and Communist parties. They were all wiped out in the 50s. And I'll stop there, because otherwise it's a long lecture that it's not
I'm going to ask you another question, and I get this all the time. People, if you tell people that you're supporting Jill Stein, they'll tell you a vote for Stein is a vote for Trump. Mm-hmm. What do you say about that?
Well, a vote for Trump can also be a vote for Clinton because of election fraud. And that's kind of goes to how illegitimate our election system is. And both major parties, even Bernie Sanders and even, you know, the most progressive Democrats, are not talking about, or rather, they don't talk specifically about what kind of election reforms they want to do. They'll talk about reforming elections, maybe, if they're pushed. But what are they going to do? The Greens have a platform. We're ready to fight for that. That is the, like, that is thing number one. And that goes to the issue that a lot of the stigma of the Greens voting third party and being in, you know, in democratic politics, independent politics, comes from an ignorance. An ignorance of what Greens are about, what our stated purpose is. And this kind of goes to, and generally in Albany and elsewhere in America, people trust independents like Bernie Sanders or stated independents of any kind, and they dislike parties. Perfectly natural. Because parties, as they are, the two major parties especially, are bought and bossed. They're bought by Wall Street, and they have a top-down structure of bosses and control. And I'd like to draw a parallel that the Green Party is not bought. We don't take corporate money. All of our fundraising is from members and people friendly to the Greens and friendly to our campaigns. And we're unbossed. We don't. We will hold candidates accountable, you know, if they're completely off the rails or they're going against our stated platform. But otherwise, if you're, and the platform is pretty broad, especially our 10 key values, our four pillars, which is economic democracy, economic justice, nonviolence, and a fourth thing. And people don't really know. You know, whenever I talk about the Greens and actually explain what we are, what we're for, people light up. People get interested. That stigma evaporates because the stigma is created by our media culture, which it's a drumbeat that a third-party vote is a wasted vote. It's a protest. Even Bernie Sanders in his switch and his support for the party establishment will say, now is not the time for a protest vote. He sounds like every politician I've ever heard in my life that said that now is not the time to protest. And these will be, you know, any kind of protest. And these will be politicians who will say they're on your side, that they're working for you. They just need more time. They don't want disruption. Just don't disrupt now. Disrupt later or disrupt when I tell you to. And that is bossing. And Greens don't do that. If you join the Greens, we're not going to boss you around like Democrats do. It doesn't become, we do not bully people into voting for us or not voting for us or supporting a platform or not. You know, it's, we consider ourselves, the Greens, to be the big tent party for the left, because the left don't have a party. The left considers the Democrats to be their party. They are not. They have not been so since before I was born, when they decided to take big corporate money over big union money. They stopped being the party for unions and workers, and they started being the party of technocrats, of Silicon Valley, Wall Street investors, and the finance industry.
Now, throughout the country, you know, the Green Party is a third party, and there's not many people who have joined the party. And people, like I just said, they said, oh, you can't vote for, you know, Jill Stein, you know, is a wasted vote. Now, in that case, there will never be an alternative third party, and the people will continue to vote, not in their interest with the Republicans and Democrats. How do you break through that mindset and let them know it's long term, eventually you will succeed and it'll be a party for everyone?
I think it's also possible to make a short term argument. First, there's kind of a point about how an analogy that, you know, any kind of business or store will go out of business if it doesn't get any support. It can't grow. People need to shop there. And of course, conversely, the store needs to offer something. What we offer is an independent place to be political, because we're on Boston on Bob, right, as I said. Day one, if we were to, say, gain power, even marginally, right, with a few seats or a few executives, we would be fighting for election reform, for either a multi-party system, or even if there's enough support, which there likely is, a system without parties. We would work to make ourselves obsolete if it meant that we had actual democracy, direct, participatory democracy. I'm always mispronouncing that, but for participation. It kind of goes to how you kind of, what activists and citizens need, what any citizen needs, is kind of a theory, a worldview of how social change happens. And a lot of people I speak to, it's very weak, it's very unformed. You know, it's something they thought about maybe a little bit, but if they do, it's based on information that they're presented to, ideas that are presented by the mainstream media, that social change happens through running for office, taking donations, and working on the inside. You know, making a joke that any rebel in any movie, never mind that. But there's usually three theories of change, especially when it comes to relationship to power. You could be autonomous movements that are autonomous and separate from power. Absorption, where a movement disrupts and then seeks to join that the power structure. And you could, and it's kind of weird, and there's a tension in movements today, like such as Black Lives Matter or the Bernie Sanders movement. Are we autonomous? Are we independent of the Democratic Party? And we're going to work, or we're going to disrupt the Democratic Party and then join it so we can get what we want, get this list of demands. In the middle is an articulation with power, where movements link up with parties, whether they're main parties or third parties or new parties. Maybe the movement makes its own party. An articulation with power in which, like the relationship of civil society, nonprofits, neighborhood organizations of all types that are not corporate, they're not legal, you know, they don't have a legal designation, right? They don't need to pay taxes or something like that. And they articulate their power with state power. And that's kind of my goal, my vision of a government in the future is a government that is either fused or replaced with civil society. So we need to ask the question, why are not environmental activists making the environmental regulations? Why aren't the people with student debt making the policies regarding student debt and where loans come from? And why are not communities in charge of where money creation comes from? Because the great thing about the student loan debt issue and the Green New Deal, which is basically a big infrastructure bank, is we the state, makes money to pay for things. And because what we're paying for instantly makes something of value, whether it's infrastructure or absolving debt, so thus that frees up our incomes to actually go into the economy and not the banks or back into some trust, it means that inflation won't go up. It means you can create all the money you want as long as it's equal to the value of either that exists or can be produced. And that's real economics. That's an economics that's untied to these old ideas of, you know, math equations and this and mechanistic thinking of interest rates and all these things that are pretty much meant and displayed to obfuscate the truth that we have a ruling class that steals from us.
So Monday is going to be the first debate, and it's only going to be between Clinton and Trump. How do you think the dynamics would have changed if the Libertarian Party and the Green Party was represented at the debates?
Well, I think it would change the way that many people, I think there was a poll, 70%, 75, support those candidates, third parties being included. They would expect that real issues would actually be brought up and discussed. I think, I forget who, but it was brought up in my newsfeed that someone, kind of a media group or college, looked at the number of times in the presidential campaign between the two main candidates. Are real issues, they asked the question, are real issues being brought up in any of their speeches and press conferences? The answer is no. Issues are not being brought up. They're talking about either things that are considered wedge issues or general cultural questions. And that's a lot of the, you know, a lot of people are voting for Hillary, or they state they will, to rebuff the culture of white supremacy and neo-fascism. I retort that we do not beat fascism with a vote. We're not beating them with the law. We can't depend on the courts to sort this out. If they're organizing, the only thing that can beat organized power is organized power. We have to organize ourselves. And a bunch of individuals acting individually with their votes, with their media accounts, with their social media accounts, and with their opinions, which are kind of, that they kind of founded on their own, based on their own consumption of media, their individual consumption. You know, nothing is better for your own consciousness than being part of a reading group where everyone reads something, so you're all reading the same content. And then you together as a group discuss what it meant to you, what you think about it. That way you can actually have more than one opinion and hear them. And it might not be yours, but you at least know they exist. And a lot of people don't know all the different viewpoints that exist, especially left-wing ones. And that's why I'm working with WCAA and the local radio station to get that up so I can have a show, that I can have my own voice and express the things that I'm talking about, because as you can hear, I can talk for quite a while and go through all these tangents. I like to have a bit of time for that because otherwise no one hears them. It's like, if no one hears them, it's like it doesn't exist. And to mainstream media and people like Chris Churchill, they don't exist. It's all fantasy, not real. because it's visionary, because it's imagined, because it's the future that we're talking about, something we're imagining. And that's a stigma itself, that something you imagine, that something that, you know, you think about, it isn't real, and thus, like a unicorn. But that's it's an Enlightenment idea, and we owe a lot to the past. But there's also a lot of ideas we need to evolve past, especially with what we know now and what we've learned from the 20th century. Otherwise, we end up with kind of mechanistic policy setting where we get into feedback loops like chemicals hurt bee populations. Then we use another type of thing to then solve the bee crisis, which then hurts something else. Or like with our energy, we get into a feedback loop where we are digging out the lower grade oil, which then creates more dirty pollution, which then accelerates climate change, which then causes more crises, which we need more fuel and resources to address, and then we destroy more of the environment in the process.
Well, this conversation will undoubtedly continue as the election wears on. So as we get closer to Election Day, would you be interested in coming back and focus on Albany to share your Green Party views?
Of course.
You've been listening to Dan Platt, Green Party member for Dan Platt, talking about Jill Stein's presidential campaign. I'm Cynthia Pooler, the host of Focused on Albany. If you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, subscribe to iTunes, and if you have a comment or criticism about this show, hashtag on Twitter, Focus on Albany. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.
Pleasure.